in the living room. I'll bring my superhero sleeping bag and unroll it on the floor of your room.
Wait, which one of us are you going to visit, Albie? Corey asked, his hand in Greer's hair, lazily rubbing her head. That is, if Greer and I aren't at the same college, which we really hope to be, preferably at one of the Ivies, he added with casual arrogance.
First I'll visit Greer, then you, said Albie. And one day you can visit me at my college.
And I can sleep in my superhero sleeping bag when I do, Corey said.
No, said Albie seriously. That makes no sense. When I go to college, you'll be 32. You won't want a sleeping bag. You and your wife will want a bed.
Yes, Corey, said Greer. You and your wife will want a bed.
Greer could be your wife, Albie said, but she has to convert to Catholic, like us.
How do you know about converting? Asked Corey.
I read about it.
Where? In the little golden book of converting? You scare me, Albie. Slow down, brother. You don't have to know everything already.
Yes, I do. Ask me a question and I'll tell you the answer.
Okay, said Corey. When did the dinosaurs go extinct?
Albie slapped his forehead. That's too easy, he said. 65 million years ago.
He'll be good when he gets to Paths of Imagination, Greer said. He'll whip right through it.
Yeah, he'll kick Taryn the Recycling Girl's butt.
By the time he's in school, said Greer, Taryn the Recycling Girl will be sitting on her porch thinking about the highlight of her life, the time when she was a child and got into the Guinness Book of World Records.
Actually, she'll probably be dead, said Corey. The toxic chemicals in all the bottles she collected will have given her cancer and killed her.
Who's going to be dead? Give me another one, said Albie, full of lofty excitement.
Corey thought about this.
Okay, he said, and he smiled at Greer. Try this one. Define love.
Albie stood up on the plastic surface of the couch, which crunched beneath his feet. He wore a thin, old red Power Rangers sweatshirt handed down from Corey and already too small, the image and the lettering half rubbed off and cryptic.
Love is when you feel like, oh, my heart hurts, Albie said. Or like when you see a dog and you feel like you have to touch its head. He looked at Greer. Like the way Corey is touching your head now.
Corey stopped the movement of his hand, just froze there in her hair.
Whoa, said Corey softly, taking his hand away. You're like the Dalai Lama, man. I'm afraid to let you go walking around outside. Some people might come and bring you back to their country and make you live in a gated palace.
That would be good, said Albie. They can do that if they want.
Greer suddenly reached over and touched Albie's small, sleek head. Corey watched his girlfriend pet the head of his brother as if Albie were a cocker spaniel, smooth-furred and enormous of eye. Corey and Greer would try to be together for college. That was what they agreed, and they were optimistic it would happen. On the spring day when most of their college decisions would be revealed online after 5 p.m., they rode home from school barely talking. The hydraulic doors of the district school bus unshuttered and released them with a vacuum pop onto the mouth of Woburn Road. Behind them, distantly, was Kristen Vells. Kristen was not on an academic track, and so they had never even had a conversation with her over all these years. They thought she was dumb. And she thought they were dumb, each in a different way. Kristen went home to her house, probably to smoke and nap, and Corey and Greer ran pounding down Woburn toward the Kadetskys. It was only 3:30. They lingered for a while in Greer's bedroom, undisturbed.
"Whatever happens today, we're solid, right?" he asked her. "And we'll be solid next year, too."
"Of course." She paused. "Why? What are you expecting to happen?"
He shrugged.
"I don't know.
It's just that they don't know us, these admissions committees. They don't know what we're really like, or that we do best when we're with each other. They had decided that they would find out their college decisions together, first at her house, and then at his. At 5 p.m., Greer went first, sitting at the kitchen table and logging into the relevant websites one after another, alphabetically. Her hand shook a little as she entered her password and waited. "We received a number of applicants," came the tumble of words. The shock of rejection was strong. Harvard, no. Princeton, no. Oh, shit, said Greer, and Corey gripped her hand. "It's insanely competitive," he murmured. "But really, screw them, Greer. They're just wrong."
"This is what you meant when you said we're solid, isn't it?" Greer said, her voice rising. "You thought I wasn't going to get in, and you were trying to prepare me."
"No, of course not." The Yale decision still hung there at the end of the alphabet, but by now Corey felt sorry for her and worried for himself and didn't hold out too much hope for her for Yale if she hadn't gotten into those others. Greer clicked indifferently on the Yale link and entered her password, and when the music flooded out all at once, the Yale fight song, "Bulldog, Bulldog, Bow, Wow, Wow," they both started to shout, and then Greer cried, and he put his arms around her, so relieved, and said, "Nice work, Space Cadetsky." Her parents wandered in then, her father looking for something to eat, and her mother cradling her flip phone and talking into it about a new shipment of Comcel Nutricol bars, which, she was saying, we now have in Banana Blast.
"What's going on?" Rob asked,
and then Greer told them, and he said,
"Oh, shit, it's already 5? We lost track."
Corey wanted to say to Greer's parents, "You lost track? Are you shitting me? Don't you know what you have here with this girl? Don't you know how hard she works and how much she loves it? Why can't you be more proud of her? Why can't you appreciate her? It's so easy to do."
"Mom, Dad, I got into Yale," Greer said. "You can read the letter. I left it up on the computer."
Next, he and Greer ran across the road and up the incline, and right away, Corey sensed something strange going on inside his own house. Both of his parents knew that today was when decisions would be handed down. They were so invested in this whole process, and yet where were they? They were behaving almost as cavalierly as the Kadetskys. They should have been waiting for him by the door, he thought. But then his mother was upon him out of nowhere, throwing her arms around him.
"Around my legs," he later insisted, hyperbolic.
How such a small woman could have given birth to this tall, thin, pole child was bewildering, as even Corey's father was only of medium height and build. The first son had gone beyond them in all ways.
"What's going on?"
Corey said, and deeper in the house other voices rose up. He heard his brother shouting, "He's home!" followed by the thumping of Albie's sneakers as he raced overhead and then leaped down the stairs with Slowey in hand, arriving at the same time that Aunt Maria pushed into the room from the kitchen, carrying a large aluminum pan containing a sheet cake. His father was right behind them, carrying a second cake. Corey was confused. The first cake was spread thickly with blue and white frosting, with a brush fire of candles on top. The air in the room was tinged with a distinctive birthday smell.
"Look at the picture," his aunt said,
and at first neither Corey nor Greer understood why the cake had been decorated with an illustration of an animal.
"A cow?" Corey asked. "But why?"
It did look like a cartoon cow, though not quite, with a freckled face and an angry expression. No one answered, and Corey said,
"Listen, you guys, you know the decisions are live online right this minute, right? These cakes are great, but I really have to go check."
"Corey,"
Albie said, gesturing in the air with the hand that held his turtle, which waved in half-hearted protest.
"Don't you get it?"
"No."
"It's a bulldog."
As soon as Corey hesitantly said,
"Yale?"
his father presented the second sheet cake to him. This one was frosted white and orange with a big rust-colored animal in the center. Though it, too, resembled a farmyard animal, Corey and Greer both understood now that it was supposed to be the Princeton Tiger.
"You got into both places, a full ride," said Albie, as if he really understood the significance of this.
Corey stared at his family. "But how do you know already? I haven't even logged in."
"Forgive me," said Benedita. "I enter your login, then your password. I know them."
"Greer 123, said Albie, and over to the side, Corey could see Greer's pleased expression. He ought to have been furious with his mother for denying him his moment of reckoning, but he wasn't. Also, she was so happy right now. Both of his parents were. Tonight, the news would be all over Fall River and all over Portugal.
"Harvard turned you down," Albie continued breezily. "But who needs them, right?"
The crimson cake, baked alongside the others just in case, was still in the kitchen and would later be tossed in the trash. Benedita had spent the day baking with Aunt Maria, whose own son, Sab, wouldn't be going to college. Out of all the cousins, Corey and Albie had long ago been pegged as the most academic ones. Corey had already proven himself in this way, and Albie was certainly going to follow and most likely exceed his older brother. The day they had discovered Albie could read was when, still a toddler, he'd been gazing at a box of fruity pebbles at the breakfast table, and in the clatter of the morning kitchen had quietly begun to whisper to himself,
"Red 40, yellow 6, BHA to help protect flavor."
Now Corey would have to pick between Yale and Princeton, a bulldog or a tiger. What a decision. If he went to Yale, he and Greer would be together. So really, it wasn't a decision at all. Yale was where he would go. Greer and Corey sat at the kitchen table eating slices of different colored cake, both of which tasted identical on the tongue. No one in the world had ever eaten sheet cake for taste, only for celebration. "Greer got into Yale, too," Corey told his family, and they exclaimed politely over her success.
"Full ride?" Albie asked. "I didn't look yet. I was so excited."
Greer stood up from the table. "I have to go home and see."
"I'll come," Corey said.
Back at the Kadetsky house, they found Greer's parents staring at the computer.
"Shit," her father said as they approached. "This is not going to work."
"What are you talking about?" Greer said.
"The aid package."
He sighed heavily and shook his head. Suddenly, Corey understood the whole thing. It revealed itself before him, sickeningly.
"What?"
Greer said, still not getting it.
"We can't swing it," said Rob. "They were extremely stingy with us, Greer."
"But how can that be?" she asked. She and Corey examined the paragraph about the amount of award. The next paragraph said something like, "Given that you did not choose to provide the appropriate information and documentation," and then went on to apologetically say that Yale could only offer so much and no more. The amount it offered was a token. Apparently Rob, who had volunteered to handle the financial aid forms, hadn't actually completed them. He had left out parts that had seemed too complicated or else too intrusive. Rob explained this calmly but haltingly now.
"I'm so sorry, Greer," he said. "I didn't know it would have this effect."
"You didn't know?"
"I thought they would come back to us, the financial aid people, and say they needed more information. I filled out what I could, and then it got to be too much, and I got pissed off at how much they wanted from me, answers I didn't know and would have to go digging around for, and I guess I did a half-assed job."
He paused, shaking his head.
"That's what I do," he said. "That's what I always do."
Laurel picked up a letter that was lying on the table.
"There's one more thing, though, one more place. I just went and got the mail. Ryland," she said.
"What?"
"You got in. They offered you a really extraordinary package. Room, board, even spending money. I was worried you'd be upset about Yale, so I opened it. This solves the problem." Right, Ryland, Greer said with sarcasm. My safety school, where my guidance counselor made me apply, a school for dummies. That's not true. And don't you want to see the letter? You won something called the Ryland Scholarship for Academic Excellence. It has nothing to do with finances. It's only based on merit. I don't actually care.
I know you're upset, Laurel said. Dad fucked up, she said, giving Rob a sharp, furious look, and then her face grew pinched, and she began to cry.
Laurel, I thought they would come back and ask for the information again later, Rob repeated, and he came and stood beside his wife, starting to cry too. Both of Greer's parents, these hapless, slightly unruly-looking people, were crying together and hugging each other, while Greer sat with Corey at the table with her hands in fists. Corey thought about how your parents brought you into the world, and you were supposed to stay close to them, or at least near them, until the moment when you had to swerve away. This, now, was Greer's swerve. He was witnessing it in action. He reached across and grabbed her hands and opened them. She relented, let his fingers wind together with hers. His own parents had filled out the financial aid forms perfectly, intimidated, while Corey guided them. He had bossed his parents around, telling them what to fill in on every single line. His parents were innocents, but they had done the right thing, while Greer's parents, who should have known better, hadn't.
But look, Laurel went on, we have to move forward now, and this Ryland scholarship is pretty amazing. You'll do fine. You and Corey both will. You're both so smart. You know how I think of you two? How I picture you? Like twin rocket ships.
Greer didn't even respond. She looked at Corey and said, maybe I can call Yale. So he and Greer went upstairs to her room to make the call. First, Greer was put on hold, and finally a harried woman answered. All in a rush, Greer started to tell her tale of anguish while Corey sat on the bed beside her. Greer's voice was soft and unclear, even in this moment of urgency. He'd never understood this about her. He himself was certainly imperfect, defensive, sometimes condescending, but at least he could speak up without anxiety, and his voice came out easily.
The forms weren't really... And my dad said... He heard Greer say.
He wanted to tell her, say what you mean. Speak up, girl. I'm sorry, the woman finally interrupted. The financial aid decisions have already been made.
Okay, I understand, Greer said quickly, and then she hung up. Maybe my parents could call, she said to Corey.
Go ask them, he said. Tell them it's important to you. Say it in a serious voice, like you mean business.
So they went back downstairs, and she approached her parents and said, would either of you call the office at Yale for me? Her mother just looked at her anxiously. This is your father's department, she said. I wouldn't know what to say.
Didn't you just call over there? What did they say to you? Rob asked.
They said the decisions were already made, but you could try, Greer said. You're a parent. Maybe it would be different.
I can't, he said. The bureaucracy of it all. It's not for me.
He looked helplessly at Greer.
It's just nothing I could do comfortably, he added.
Then, for emphasis, he said again,
I can't.
They actually weren't going to try to help her, Corey saw with astonishment. He was witnessing a tableau of Greer's entire childhood being enacted before him, and it created in him an intense fury, as well as a desire to protect Greer and love her harder. Greer accepted the full ride at Ryland, and Corey chose Princeton. If he'd gone to Yale, it would have been a constant, sharp reminder to Greer. Their paths were now diverging precipitously. The swerve affected not just her and her parents, but also him, so they would have to work to keep themselves as close as possible. On their last night together at the end of the summer, up in her bedroom with a strong rain battering the windows, Greer lay in Corey's arms and cried. She hadn't cried about college before now, because her parents had cried that day in the kitchen, and she had wanted to distinguish her own response from theirs. Also, she had wanted to be better than they were, stronger. But she cried there in bed with Corey.
"I don't want to be this damaged person," Greer said, her voice choked, her face turned sharply away from him.
"You aren't. You're totally fine."
"You think so? I'm so quiet. I'm always the quiet one."
"I fell in love with your quiet," he said into the little blue section of her hair. "But that's not all you are."
"Are you sure of that?"
"Of course I am. And other people will start to see it, too. They really will."
The rain came down, and they barely moved. And then, finally, when it got late, they rose with little groans and separated so they could finish packing up their childhood rooms, going through the task of selecting what they still cared about, what made the cut because it was still a part of them, and what was necessary to leave behind for good. Greer scooped up her collection of snow globes and her Jane Austen novels, even Mansfield Park, which she had never particularly liked. It was as if the books were a lineup of stuffed animals that had graced her room all these years. That was how much they comforted her. Corey, who would be leaving for Princeton in the morning, left behind his row of NBA bobblehead figurines on a shelf so Albie could have them. But after hesitating, he took the boxed set of The Lord of the Rings. He wasn't particularly literary, but he loved those books and would never stop loving them. Pretty soon, Albie would want to read them too, he knew, and when that happened, he would lend them to him. The next day, after goodbyes so ardent and extensive that they had a World War II quality to them, Corey went off in his packed family car for the trip down to New Jersey. Greer would go to Ryland 2 days later. At Princeton, Corey was given a job in the Firestone Library, checking out books in an enormous grand room. He ate his meals in another enormous grand room. He and Greer Skyped at night and made the effort to travel frequently to see each other. He spoke to her about being intimidated by Princeton, but loving it there, too, and about playing ultimate frisbee on the greenest fields on earth. He didn't tell her that he worried about staying faithful to her, and worried more broadly that what they had agreed to was going to be difficult to sustain. Girls at Princeton flirted with him all the time. Waspy blonde girls who had grown up in houses with names, and a cool black flute player from L.A., and a boho genius who lived in the Netherlands, though she was American, and was named Chia. Then one day in the dining hall, he heard one girl say to another, "Here's something about me that you didn't know. I made it into the Guinness Book of World Records." And the other girl said, "Really? What for?" "Oh, I collected more bottles for recycling than any other kid ever had. It was my thing. I was famous in Toledo. I was such a little dweeb." Corey whipped around, practically spitting cobbler.
"You're Taryn the recycling girl?" he asked, shocked. "I read about you in my fourth grade reader."
And the girl, who happened to be gorgeous, with wavy dark hair and dark eyes, nodded and laughed. That night on Skype, Corey made Greer guess who he had met that day.
"Just guess," he said.
But she was unable to guess, and so he told her. He left out the detail that Taryn, the recycling girl from Toledo, was really hot now, and that she had asked him if he wanted to meet for a drink sometime. "Glass, not plastic," Taryn had said, giving the words a suggestive James Bond quality. And then there was Corey's secret Santa, Clove Wilberson, who had grown up in Tuxedo Park, New York, in a house called Marbridge.
"Dang, Corey Pinto, you are the cutest and the wootest," Clove said to him one day in response to nothing.
"Both?"
he said mildly. He also didn't tell Greer that one night Clove Wilberson came up to him after a party and said,
"Corey Pinto, You are miles taller than I am, so I can barely do what I want to do.
Which is what?
She'd pulled his face down toward hers and kissed him. Their mouths touched in a meeting of soft surfaces.
So did you like that, Cory Pinto?
She asked when they pulled away. For some reason, it amused her to always call him by his full name. Then she quickly said,
Don't answer that. I know you have a girlfriend. I've seen you with her. But it's okay. You don't have to look so scared.
I'm not scared, he said. But almost immediately, he felt compelled to run his hand across his mouth. Sometimes he would see Clove's room from below, and when the light was on, he would imagine going up there and not saying anything, but just pulling her onto her bed, the same way he pulled Greer onto the bed when she came to Princeton or he drove up to Ryland. Everything Clove Wilberson said to him was through a scrim of teasing. And whenever he saw Taryn the recycling girl, she would say, So when are we drinking out of glass, not plastic, together? How would he get through 4 years of college not having sex with anyone but Greer? He was excited by different girls all the time, now that he wasn't with Greer every day. He wished he could say to her, Let's have one day a week when we get to hook up with someone on our own campus, someone who means nothing to us, but who fulfills a shallow hormonal need. You can hook up with that drummer friend of yours. He is totally into you, I can tell. But Greer would have been shocked, and he couldn't hurt her. Back home in Macapi over spring break freshman year, when they were sitting together at Pyland studying, Greer had reached across the table and absently touched Corey's face. Her hand stroked his cheek, for a moment staying on the small, pale scar there, which was now over a year old. He had imagined that when they were older and in the next phase of their lives, living in their apartment together in Greenpoint or Red Hook, or was it Redpoint and Green Hook, that would be the right time to confess to her his modest but valiant tale of having once saved her from the indignity of having a group of high school boys declare her a six, and then taking an injury to the face for it.
I always knew you were really a nine. He'd been planning to say.
But he was slightly older now, and changing. And lately, Greer had begun to speak to him with a certain halting eloquence about the way women were treated in the world. He finally understood how arrogant his confession would have been. His little scar, which had grown thin and white and nearly invisible, had been a badge of honor connected to a story he'd looked forward to telling her. Now he knew he never would. Near the end of college, Corey thought there ought to be a book called The Alcohol Speaking, in which people wrote about all the things they had done while drunk. The problem was that they might not remember them when it came time to write them down. Princeton was full of decisions made while drunk. Corey had hooked up with Clove Wilberson twice sophomore year, and then again once junior year. It had been the alcohol speaking, he knew, and he had been full of regret and remorse each time it happened. He couldn't really blame it on Clove, but there she was one night, practically doing a lap dance for him. Corey had such long legs that they often just fell open when he sat in chairs. Years later, on the subway in New York, women would look annoyed with him, and he didn't understand why, until once during rush hour a woman stared him down and said, Enough with the man-spreading! He was mortified and clapped his legs back together like a machine part. But in a butterfly sling chair in an over-decorated suite at Princeton sophomore year, after a vodka tasting given by a senior named Valentin Semenov, the son of a genuine oligarch, Corey leaned back and let Clove pour herself over him like syrup.
Oh my God! He said, when the lights went low and she opened his fly.
A zipper being opened was like a little shock, especially when the hand holding the zipper pole was not Greer's. Greer, whose absence was now as strong as a presence, and the worth of whose love was unquantifiable, making Corey perhaps richer than the richest oligarch. I'm sorry, he thought. I really am. But as he was thinking this, The alcohol wasn't just thinking, but was in fact speaking. And beloved, invaluable Greer, with her blue streak and her sexy little body and her growing desire to be more outgoing and do something of meaning in the world, fell straight down through a trap door, away from him, away. Meanwhile, Clove Wilberson cleverly sidestepped that trap door, straddling Corey on the butterfly chair and then eventually in her bed. Finally, he saw her dorm room not from below, but from within. Loads of ribbons and trophies for field hockey, loads of doodads that belonged to a rich girl. While they were in her bed, her parents called twice, and both times she took the call. She told him she had a horse named Boyfriend Material who would be running in Saratoga that summer. "Bet on him. I'm confident he's going to win," she said sweetly into Corey's ear. The next day he said, "Clove, listen, I can't do this again."
"I know you can't."
She didn't seem upset, and he thought, was I no good? But he knew he was good. He was unruined and strong and energetic. Because of Greer, mostly, he knew what he was doing sexually. Clove smiled at him and said, "Don't worry, Corey Pinto." So he didn't worry. But two more times over the course of college he returned to her, starting up the pattern of shame and absolution and cycling unhappily through it. But it was the alcohol speaking every time. Being apart from Greer allowed these changes to happen. There were other changes, too. During the fall of the presidential campaign, he and Greer skipped weekends that they were meant to see each other, and instead went separately campaigning. Greer went to Pennsylvania on a Ryland bus. Corey went to Michigan on a Princeton bus. Clove was somewhere on that same bus, but he sat up front with Lionel and across the aisle from Will, his two future microfinance startup partners. They were all overexcited by the campaign and could stay up all day and night in the way you could only do without penalty when you were that age. For weeks after the election, Corey was so elated and relieved and unworried about the future.
"Hey, Corey, Will and I wanted to talk to you," said Lionel one evening as the three of them walked across campus. "Looking ahead here, we can't get going on the startup right out of school. We'll need a year or two. By then we'll have more capital."
"The thing is," said Will, "because of the economy, our dads are feeling less generous. So we should all make a pact to go out there after we graduate and earn a shitload of money ourselves first and use it later," said Lionel. "Like saving up acorns for winter. Will and I are both going to try to get jobs in finance or consulting. You should do that too." At first, this news depressed Corey, and he refused to consider their suggestion. But much later, as graduation drew closer, he became more comfortable with the idea of consulting for a year or two, though it wasn't at all what he had planned. So many people around him were becoming consultants. Along with banking and business school, it was one of the paths of least resistance. The top firms swarmed the top campuses, and many of the students went willingly. Over a designated period during Corey's senior year, recruiters from consultancies and VC firms and banks descended upon Princeton in their good, tailored suits. They distinguished themselves from the students who carried backpacks and were dressed in rumple wear, and from the male faculty in their oatmeal tweed and low-slung corduroys that revealed their deflated, tenured asses, and from the female faculty in shaggy, earthy, academic latter-day Stevie Nicks dress, ambling into the long, less frequently tenured, as Greer had pointed out, home stretch of the rest of their lives. After the initial interview, a man and a woman from Armitage and Rist took Corey out to dinner in downtown Princeton, at one of those ye old restaurants where parents took their sons or daughters when visiting from far-off hometowns. The consultants urged him to get an appetizer first. Did they think he was hungry? He wondered. Were they thinking of him as vaguely ethnic scholarship male Exhibit A? "Get whatever you like," one of the two recruiters said, a man 10 years older than Corey and wearing a stylish suit and narrow beetle boots. His female colleague, with hair and skin that looked highly touchable, wore a red leather skirt and jacket that fit her tightly, futuristically.
"You know, it'll be fun to see where you go," the woman said to Corey as he ate, and as the two of them simply watched him eat, rather than actually eating much of anything themselves. Ordering was not the same as eating.
"Even if you already know you don't want to go with us," added the man, "even if you're fielding offers, Corey, but are leaning in another direction."
"I'm not doing that," Corey said, but because there was food in his mouth, it came out like, "I'm not doing that."
"The world is totally open now," the man went on. "It's changing before our eyes. When you look at the profile of our firm, of all the firms, really, it's a great time to be you. I envy you, actually, Corey. I'm excited for you and all your options."
But what did they mean by you? Did they mean because he was a millennial? Or was he being lumped into the minority category again because of his last name? Back during freshman year, someone had slipped a flyer under his door inviting him to a meeting of one of the campus Latino organizations. "We'll be serving chalupas," it had read. In the candlelight of their corner table at the restaurant, the man and woman from Armitage and Rist wooed Corey Pinto like two lovers proposing a three-way. So Corey ate salty smoked salmon on crisp little rounds of black bread and a rack of meat like something on the Flintstones, followed by a ramekin of creme brulee with a hard, scorched crust on top that, when you cracked it with the tip of your spoon, felt as satisfying as if you were breaking ground to build your dream home. The recruiters were so complimentary throughout dinner, even as they left out a lot of specifics. The firm had offices in New York, London, Frankfurt, and Manila, they said, but Corey stressed that he definitely needed to be in New York.
"We hear you," said the woman.
Back in his dorm room after the meal, lightly burping little bursts of aerated fish and mustard, Corey had Skyped with Greer at Ryland.
"Well, guess what? They sold me on it," he said.
"Is that right?"
"Yep. They threw a lot of red meat at me, and that did it. You would have hated what I ate. You would have actually been grossed out by the whole evening. But I have to admit, I was into it. I mean, it was so ridiculous having strangers from a firm. Even that word is so weird. Fawn over me like I was somebody. Having capitalism itself seek me out and think I might actually have something to offer it. It's just for a year. Two tops. But I'm telling you, Greer, if you're down with it, I really might do it."
"You say it like you're talking about some dangerous activity."
"Everything has risk."
"What do you think the risk is here?"
"Oh, just that I will become a consulting asshole while you become someone good."
"I don't know why you say that," Greer said. "I don't even have a job yet."
"You will."
"I do actually have an idea for some place interesting to apply," she said with surprising coyness.
"Tell me."
"No, not yet. It probably won't become anything, and I have to find out first. But anyway," she said directly into the camera, "even if you become an asshole, and even if I become this sanctimonious person, we'll be doing it in front of each other, for each other, finally. And doesn't that count for something?" He didn't answer right away. She looked at him hard, and he could swear she seemed to know everything about everything he had ever done, all that was good and all that was shameful. For a second, he almost wished the Skype connection would blink out briefly, the way it sometimes did in the middle of an important moment. But it stayed strong, and Greer just smiled at him and placed a single finger on the screen, most likely in the exact place where his mouth was.
Part 2. Twin Rocket Ships. Chapter 4. She had come down by bus, staying awake and sitting up straight the whole time so she didn't inadvertently fall asleep and crease her clothes and face, winding up looking the way she imagined her parents had looked back on the school bus before she was born. She needed to look uncreased and responsible now, like someone who should be hired to work at this modest feminist magazine that had survived long past its peak. Someone who should be hired to work for Faith Frank. Greer had told very few people about the interview, but even fewer knew that she didn't really love Bloomer. Though it had started out in life as a tough little readable magazine, after almost 40 years it was somewhat soft and had a hard time competing with blogs such as Femme Fatale, which had shifted away from personal essays and was embracing a radical critique of racism, sexism, capitalism, and homophobia. Recently, Femme Fatale had run a cartoon of Amelia Bloomer wearing the bloomers associated with her name, which had words on them that read, Bloomer Magazine. And in a dialogue bubble, she was saying, time to give another pep talk to straight, white, middle-class women. Femme Fatale's staff was young, and from their offices in a former candy factory in Seattle, they wrote about and organized around issues like queer rights, trans rights, and reproductive justice. Bloomer tried too, but while the editorial staff was pretty diverse, and diversity was among the topics frequently covered, there was a formal, slightly uneasy quality to the magazine. It hadn't made a graceful leap forward. Even its website was slightly grainy and sleepy. Bloomer's offices were now located in a small commercial building in the far west 30s. As Greer walked down the narrow hall, she could hear the whinny of the dental drill behind the door of a Dr. L. Ragney, DDS. Across the hall, she buzzed at the door of Bloomer, but no one answered, so she stood waiting. She coughed, as if that might help, and watched as someone approached Dr. L. Ragney's door and was buzzed in at once. It was a bright spring workday in New York City, and for whatever reason, no one was answering the door at Bloomer. Greer turned the knob, but the door was locked. Then she banged, but still no one appeared. She was confused, but more than that, the lack of response made her realize how much she really wanted a job there, and that if she didn't get one, she would be very disappointed. Faith Frank had seemed to offer something unusual in the gray light of a ladies' room 3.5 years earlier. So now Greer stood for too long knocking on a door in this hall of dental offices and actuaries and startups. She knew there were people behind the Bloomer door. She could hear them moving around and talking. It was like when you heard mice behind your wall but couldn't find a way to get to them. That past Wednesday, Greer had nervously called the number on Faith Frank's business card, which had spent all of college in a slot in her wallet. During the occasional wallet purges that took place during times of great boredom, the card had always made the cut. Whenever she'd seen it, she'd remembered the night it had been given to her, and she would feel a specific, excited, and highly alert feeling. In recent weeks, Greer had been sending various applications to nonprofits, but had received only one interview at an organization that disseminated a life-saving nutritional supplement in developing countries in Africa. That interview, which took place over Skype, didn't go well. She had no background for this kind of work, and the pediatrician interviewing her kept being called away, leaving her to sit awkwardly in front of the empty screen for minutes at a time, staring at a poster on his wall of a dying child in her mother's arms. Finally, after all the conversations in the dorm about starting out in the world and choosing a particular field, Greer thought to apply for a job at Faith Frank's magazine. It would be meaningful work where she could use her writing skills. During the day, she would essentially be paid to be a feminist, and at night she could work on her own writing. Z agreed that it was worth trying. It would be a good fit for you. Me, I'm so bad at anything having to do with the written word, Z added, which is a shame, because it would be great to work for Faith Frank. Greer had explained to the person who answered the phone at Bloomer where and when she'd met Faith. Somehow, the next day, she had gotten a call back, and the assistant had said, "Faith remembers you." These words were so startling. Greer didn't know how it was possible that Faith Frank remembered her after 3.5 years, but she actually did. Now that no one was answering the door at Bloomer, it all seemed like an elaborate, sad prank. Finally, after far too long a time, The door was wrenched open by a young woman who looked at Greer and rudely said,
"Yes?"
"I have a job interview with Faith Frank."
"Well, that's a shame."
"Sorry?"
The woman just turned and walked into the warren of offices, past the unoccupied reception desk. In the distance, a couple of women clustered in a hallway. Greer looked for Faith, but she didn't see her. There was something so very wrong here. The unfriendly person at the door, the knot of employees, the atmosphere of loss and worry and shock. Then the cluster of women split in half, so it was like curtains parting, and between the halves, Greer got a straight-shot view of a small office at the end of the short hallway, its door open. Inside, two women were embracing. One of them was patting the other one on the back. The one doing the comforting, it was now revealed, was Faith Frank. She was the one they all looked toward in this upsetting moment.
"Did someone die?" Greer asked a middle-aged woman who stood nearby.
The woman regarded her evenly.
"Yes, Amelia Bloomer," she said.
When Greer kept looking at her, uncomprehending, the woman explained,
"We're folding. Cormor Publishing is pulling the plug once and for all. Happy Death Day to us."
"Sorry," was all Greer could say.
Her first thought, much to her shame later on, wasn't about what this meant for the mission of the magazine or its staff, but what it meant for her. Faith, who had been at Bloomer the longest, was in her middle 60s now, and the love that people felt for her, Greer knew, had to do with their feelings about the past more than anything else. Femme Fatale would be a far better place to work than Bloomer, though there was no money at the blog. Now she had no job working for Faith Frank, and never would. But as she experienced the news through her own self-absorption, she became aware that the office was growing quiet. Something was about to happen. Faith stood straighter and looked around, preparing to speak.
"Listen, my friends," she began. "Not listen, people, like an officious and exhausted teacher, and not either the latest iteration of the way people spoke to groups. Listen up, guys, especially since these were mostly women here."
"Oh, I'm heartbroken today," said Faith.
"I know we all are, but we're heartbroken together. We've done a lot. We marched together. We celebrated together. We fought for the ERA and reproductive rights and against violence. And right here in our offices, we wrote about it all. And we sat in one another's living rooms and talked about everything under the sun. And we ate sprouts together. Lots and lots of sprouts. I believe we're the ones who put sprouts on the map."
There was sentimental laughter.
"Look, some of what we did succeeded. And some of it failed spectacularly. ERA, I'm talking to you. But what I know, and you know, is that all of it mattered. And it still matters. We're part of history, the history of women's struggle for equality. Though, of course, I don't have to tell you that. We've been doing this forever, and we'll keep on doing it."
She looked up.
"Oh, please don't cry, because then we'll all cry, and we'll end up dissolving in a puddle of tears like women in the 18th century."
Some people laughed through their tears, which fractionally changed the mood. Then Faith said,
"You know what? I take that back. Let's all cry. We'll get it out of our systems once and for all, and then we'll go right back out there."
Faith was as she had been when she spoke at Ryland. Kind, intelligent, allowing for other people's emotions. The truth was that she wasn't a rare or particularly original thinker, but she was someone who used her appeal and her talents to inspire and sometimes comfort other women. Greer wouldn't get a job at Bloomer, for Bloomer would no longer exist in any form, and she wouldn't even get a chance to sit for an interview with Faith Frank, which would have been exciting, regardless of the outcome.
"This is over, and now we have to scatter," Faith told everyone. Then she gestured around her. "But this," she said, isn't over, and we all know it never will be. We are not going away. I'll see you all out there.
The women applauded, and some cried, and several of them began to speak in overlapping voices and take group photos. Someone opened a bottle of champagne, and then music played. Fittingly, Opus's old hit, The Strong Ones. Greer took that moment to leave, and as she walked out, she heard the lyrics that opened the song. Don't ever think I'll be easily beat, just because I'm wearing Louboutins on my dainty feet. We are the strong ones, we are the live ones, we are the subtle ones, we are the wise ones.
Greer felt congested with disappointment, and something more substantial and different.
She headed back into the hallway, where behind other doors the sounds of everyday life were released, the squeal of a dental drill, the throb of dubstep, the chirp and murmur of people getting business done. The world spun, even as a modest but once important feminist magazine did its death rattle and then died. Corey was in a coffee shop on the corner of West 30th Street, waiting for her as they'd arranged. She hadn't been able to tell him what time her interview would be over, so he'd said, "Don't worry, I'll just plan to be there." He was in the back booth now, in an orange Princeton hoodie, an econ text open in front of him. These days, a soul patch and a thin mustache served as a framing device for his mouth. Wordless, Greer slid into the booth beside him, and he opened his arms to her, so she went into them.
"It didn't go well?"
he asked.
"They're closing."
"Oh, no. Bad luck. Come here, you," he said,
and she turned her face up to his so he could kiss her mouth, her cheeks, her nose. He wanted her to get what she wanted. He hadn't even met Faith Frank, though he'd listened to Greer talk on and on about her after the lecture freshman year, and she'd given him a real-time course in feminism as she herself was getting it. It was much the way Greer had learned about microfinance from Corey, or at least its outlines. Here he was now, waiting for her, sympathizing with her.
"You'll find something," he said, "and they'll be lucky to hire you."
"Who's they?"
"Whoever."
"It's not just the job, exactly," she said after a moment. "It's also her and what she stands for, and how she acted when I met her, Faith Frank."
"Yes, I know. My competition."
He reached out and played with the edges of her hair, rubbing them between his fingers. He did this sometimes, she noticed, when he wasn't sure how to comfort her. She remembered the way Darren Tinsler had played with her shirt collar, not to comfort her, but for his own pleasure and interest. It made Corey nervous to see her unhappy, and she knew he wanted to swoop in and do something. Of course, it was true that he also liked to touch her. She leaned even closer, and Corey palmed her entire head with his big hand. He was touching her head, her face. Then his hand was on her neck, the thumb stroking the scooped hollow above her collarbone, and she kissed the side of his face. They were both slightly stale, having traveled from their colleges that day by bus and train. She would have liked to be in a bathtub with him, and she realized that they had never once taken a bath together. They would do that when they lived together, when all of this had been figured out and resolved. She pictured his long legs displacing the water in their tub. "I realized today, it got kind of sharply defined for me, that I wanted to know her," Greer said. "And I guess I wanted her to know me, too. I know that's hubristic, a word Professor Malik loves." She paused. "Maybe I'll write Faith Frank a note, kind of a condolence letter. You think that's okay?"
"I think you know what's okay."
"C once told me I should be Faith Frank's pen pal, but of course that was ridiculous. At least now I have something to say to her." That night, Greer sent Faith an email. "Dear Miss Frank, I came in for a job interview with you this afternoon, and I was there when you said goodbye to everyone. Listening to you talk, I felt like I knew you. I think everyone must feel that way. Thank you for all you've done over the decades for women. We are so lucky to have you.
Sincerely, Greer Kadetsky. Greer began sending her resume out more. The plan had been that after commencement, which would take place in a couple of weeks, she and Corey would spend a month up in Macapi living at home before going down to the city to try to find an apartment in Brooklyn. But Greer still had no job waiting for her. She became worried about what would happen, even a little frightened at the uncertainty. Then one day, Corey received his own disappointing news. Armitage and Rist had changed their offer and now wanted him to come work in their Manila office. They enhanced the deal with even more money, but the news was shocking, and he had been afraid to tell her. "Do we ever get to be together?" she asked.
"Yes."
"What if you tell them you won't go?"
"Then I have no job. All the entry-level consulting jobs have been locked down by now, and I need to be a big earner. Lionel and Will and I agreed on this." "Look, I feel like crap," he said. "I wanted us to be in our place. I pictured the whole thing. Framed shit on the walls, big spoons in the kitchen."
"Spoons," she said. "We never discussed that. You pictured spoons?"
"Yeah,"
he said, a little shyly. College ended in a fractured, frantic way, just as it had begun. Greer and Zee began to pack up their dorm rooms, and neither of them was happy about what immediately waited for them. Zee would be moving back home to her parents' house in Scarsdale, to live there while training to be a paralegal, which both her mother and father had urged her to do. "Semi-forced me to do," Zee said, because she had no other plans and no skills. She would have liked looking for a paid job as an activist, perhaps as a community organizer, she'd tentatively suggested, but they had swept it away.
"Be serious and think long-term," her mother had said. "Those jobs don't have earning potential."
On the very last night, the entire Ryland senior class took buses to a scruffy beach an hour away from campus, where a bonfire was built, and Dog brought out the ukulele again, and many sad, emotional songs were sung. Greer and her cluster of friends sat together in a huddle. Zee walked on the sand in circles, saying, "Really? It's all over now? This is so depressing. It's like a final field trip for people at a hospice." Greer went back up to the house in Macapi while she figured out what to do next. Corey flew business class to Manila on Cathay Pacific, settling in under a downy blanket, drinking a glass of Shingleback McLaren Vale Shiraz as the lights in the cabin dimmed.
"All you need to know about my new life," he texted her when he landed, "is that they gave me pajamas to wear on the plane."
In Macapi, Greer found a full-time job at Skatefest, the same place where she had worked part-time in high school. She spent her days now handing out skates, and her evenings sending out her resume and eating morose dinners, often by herself in front of a novel. She was finally not as angry at her parents as she used to be, she realized. They were too marginal for that, too weak. But her connection to them seemed vague, as if she had to remember who exactly these two people were. "Being here is temporary," she thought. "It's just a lily pad. It's what happens to you after college. I will be able to leap off one of these days." Corey sometimes called from Manila while Greer was sitting at the skate rental counter in the middle of the day. It was 12 hours later where he was. Their lives were opposites in all ways.
"I'm lonely, and I'm bored, and I miss you something sick," he said.
"I miss you, too. Something sick," she added. "I like that."
"I want to be in your bed right this minute, Space Kadetsky," he said. "Why can't I make myself really small and crawl through the holes of the phone?"
"Maybe you can." She paused and sighed. He sighed, too. "I had a dream last night," Greer told him, "in which we agreed to meet in the middle, which was a raft on the ocean."
"Was it nice?"
he asked. "Very. But then somehow my mother was there, dressed as a clown, kind of spoiled the mood."
"I can imagine." "You know," he said after a second, "maybe we could do something sexy over the phone." They'd had occasional phone sex and Skype sex during college. Greer had always felt a little nervous, afraid that somehow it would be intercepted.
The NSA doesn't care about your orgasms, Corey had said. Believe me.
But then again, she tended to be on the quiet side, even when they had sex in person. A nun and a mouse had a baby, and that is me, she'd said to him once after they'd slept together in her childhood bed.